cutting a swath through a great untamed land. The railroads were the driving force behind America's westward expansion. By 1866, with the end of the Civil War, rails crossed the Missouri and pushed into Kansas, dangling an irresistible lure for a new breed of outlaws. The pioneers were a gang of brothers named Reno. They struck on a rainy night in Indiana, inventing a crime that spawned 1,000 imitators. To the Reno's misfortune, however, their promising careers concluded abruptly at the end of a rope. Jesse James was the first outlaw to gain fame by facing down the giant. Brash holdups committed by his gang in the 1870s made Jesse and his brother the Robin Hoods of their era. Outlaws who traveled the trail Jesse blazed learned from his example. In Texas, a daring young robber named Sam Bass found himself an overnight legend. Sam and his gang earned their fame in the spring of 1878 by holding up 4 trains in quick succession. Bass was gallant to the ladies and polite to the gentlemen, while he picked them clean. The local press devoured the exploits of their own Jesse James and spread his renown beyond the borders of Texas.
Sam Bass seems to have had an instinct for the kind of behavior that would elicit public sympathy. He had a very short career, but he committed a significant number of train robberies in the Dallas area in a short time. He seems to have been a likable fellow that people simply took to. And he's one of the very first Western bandits who we can see consciously emulated, in this case, Jesse James. By the late 70s and early 1880s, train robberies were big news, and they were well reported. And when you have been through a train robbing the passengers, and the passengers have nice things to say about the robber, the word gets around.
Word traveled fast about Sam Bass, for no one before him had held up so many trains in such a short time. Though few of the passengers were eager to meet him face to face, even those who were robbed couldn't help but admire his audacity. Good-natured cooperation, however, was not always guaranteed. When denied access to the safe, Sam's preferred technique was to threaten to set the express car on fire. That usually got results. Sam Bass, though still in his 20s, was rich and famous.
Sam Bass was born in Indiana. It was his native home. And at the age of 17, young Sam began to roam. He first came out to Texas, a cowboy for to be. A kinder-hearted feller you seldom ever see. Sam bought himself some race stock, one called the Denton Man.
the Texas Rangers were unmoved by Sam's popularity. At the time, they were the nation's only state law enforcement agency, and they were as tough as the bandits they trailed. As one old Texan testified,
"A genuine Texas Ranger will endure cold, hunger, and fatigue almost without a murmur, and will stand by a friend and comrade in the hour of danger."
Once the Rangers took up Sam's trail, the end was in sight. In a wooded draw, the Rangers caught up with Sam Bass and his gang. The outlaws put up a desperate fight and managed to escape with their lives. The next time Sam tried to rob a bank, the Rangers were waiting. He made good his escape, but he was found the next day, mortally wounded. From Missouri to Arkansas, from Illinois to Indiana, Sam's death made the news. And a century later, in the backcountry of Texas, the tales of his short, tragic ride on the wrong side of the law would still be told with pride.
The American public has always gravitated towards the underdog, the rebel, and especially those underdogs and rebels who seem to strike out against these institutional giants. Somebody doing it on their own, with their own skill and courage, indomitable will, spirit and nerve, always attracts much greater admiration than somebody who is backed by all the power and the machinery and the apparatus of the state. And this is why the outlaws tend to be romanticized.
Poor Sam was gone, but a fashion in crime he had helped to define had only begun. In the 1880s, the railroads offered Americans a new and exhilarating form of travel. The great smoke-belching machines made it possible to journey in relative comfort to parts of the land that previously seemed inaccessible and to cover unimagined distances in a day. To a well-heeled minority, rail travel was a genteel curiosity. But the poet Walt Whitman had a more expansive vision.
"I see continual trains of cars winding along the Platte, carrying freight and passengers. I hear the locomotives rushing and roaring, and the shrill steam whistle. I hear the echoes reverberate through the grandest scenery in the world."
Despite their giddy love affair with the rails, many Americans harbored deep suspicions toward the men who built the railroads. Tycoons like Collis Huntington, Leland Stanford, Charles Crocker, and Mark Hopkins, the millionaire owners of the all-powerful Southern Pacific Railroad. It was said of these four that they had amassed extravagant fortunes by exploiting the sweat and blood of thousands of Chinese immigrants who labored under slave-like conditions to push the tracks through the mountains to the coast. It was abuses like these that made the railroads among the most reviled institutions in the nation.
The railroads ceased to be a symbol of progress, ceased to be the marvel of the age, and by the 1880s and 1890s certainly had become one of the great villains of American history. The concentration of capital that went into the great railroad companies, the way they bought and sold state and territorial legislatures, the rapacious actions of the railroad barons themselves, and the enormous fortunes they acquired at the expense of those who labored for them, all led to an incredible amount of hostility against the railroads, especially in the West, where the railroads really were the lifeline and thus had so much power over the daily lives of the people. Naturally, those who assaulted this great beast, as the railroads were thought of, were going to emerge as heroes, especially if they were successful.
The Central Valley of California produced two of these folk heroes. John Sontag was a railroad worker who bore a grudge against the SP for an injury he had suffered. His friend Chris Evans had his own reasons to hate the railroad. As a small farmer, he depended upon the railroad to move his crops to market. And like many California farmers, he resented the rates he was charged. For 15 years, his opposition to the SP was just angry talk. Then in the summer of 1892, two men robbed a Southern Pacific train of $50,000 in silver and gold. After the crime, the robbers vanished, leaving no trail. It was a job for Will Smith, the iron-willed chief of detectives for the Southern Pacific. The enemies of the SP were Will Smith's enemies, and many wound up behind bars. Idle talk among local farmers led Smith to suspect Evans and Sontag. With a deputy sheriff, he paid a visit to Chris Evans' home. Evans and Sontag weren't about to trust their fate to the hated Will Smith. Now wanted for murder, they took to the hills. For more than a month, they kept out of sight, while Will Smith and a posse of local lawmen combed the brush for a lead. In the fall, the posse approached a mountain cabin, hoping for a meal. Posse withdrew, leaving Evans and Sontag on the lam in the lonely Sierras with two more murders to their names. They would remain there through the winter, moving from camp to camp and relying on sympathetic farmers to supply them with provisions. By these same couriers, Evans sent plaintive letters to his wife, reminding her to kiss the babies for Papa. When Evans and Sontag next saw Will Smith, they were the ones caught by surprise. Badly wounded, Evans managed to crawl for several miles before he was finally captured. John Sontag was dead. His triumphant killers posed for a portrait, while Evans went to jail for 18 years. To his death, he steadfastly denied ever robbing a train.
Evans and Sontag came to symbolize all of the popular resentment against the Southern Pacific. Whether or not they actually ever robbed a train became almost immaterial. By that time, the Southern Pacific detectives were seen as hand in hand with the lawmen. They worked for the SP. The people did not feel that even the men who wore the badges of the law rather than those of the Southern Pacific, worked for them. And the resentment that came up and crystallized around Evans and Sontag resulted in a level of popular support that we may not have seen since the time of Jesse James.
Like Jesse James, Chris Evans was seen as a fighter for freedom. But already the odds in the battle had begun to stack up on the side of the law. Oklahoma Territory, 1895. Like many young men of the Western frontier, the three Jennings boys grew up wild. But one of the brothers would gain lasting fame as the most inept train robber the West had ever seen. The son of an Oklahoma judge, young Al never made much of a living as an outlaw. But he harbored visions of glory. He wanted to be famous for something. He bounced from gambling to booze. But his dream was to rob a train. His first attempt was a clumsy failure. On his second, he and his gang barely escaped capture by a posse. On his third try, Al got lucky. With a $30,000 haul from the Santa Fe Railway, he laid plans for an extended vacation in the tropical republic of Honduras. On the sleepy shores of the Caribbean, he lived, for a time, the life that many outlaws before him had only dreamed of. Under the circumstances, he was glad to befriend another young American who was running from the law. Like Jennings, William Sidney Porter had grown restless in Honduras. Before long, both threw in the towel and headed back north to face the odds at home. Now a dapper dresser in his 30s, Al regathered his gang and set out to establish himself as the greatest train robber of the age. The safe on the Rock Island Express was said to be bulging with cash. The engineer was obliging. But to open the heavy safe, Al planted a huge charge of dynamite. The blast destroyed not only the safe, but every scrap of its contents. And to make matters worse, Al had been recognized. 2 months later, a U.S. Marshal arrested the gang single-handed. Al Jennings' bungled career as a train robber had lasted a mere 4 months. In prison, to his surprise, Jennings ran into his friend from Honduras, and with time on his hands, he regaled him with yarns of his wild outlaw life. In later years, Hollywood beckoned, and Al played to a gullible press by spinning tall tales of his days as a daring train robber. As the writer O. Henry, his friend would win fame, and Al, too, in the end, gained the one thing in life he had longed for. While Al chased renown as an outlaw, the nation sped on its way, pursuing new pastimes and passions, and doing its best to forget the roots from which it had sprung. To jaded city dwellers, the Wild West seemed far away. But in the great empty places beyond the frontier, the outlaw life still thrived. It was 1896, the year the Wild Bunch was born. Like the James Gang, the Wild Bunch gained its fame by robbing trains. The gang's leader, Butch Cassidy, and his sidekick, the Sundance Kid, took naturally to the craft. The gang robbed only express cars, never the railroad passengers. And no stubborn clerk or express car safe managed to stand in their way. The gang's first train job left an express car in ruins, but netted the bunch a cool 50 grand. The size of the haul put the gang in the papers from coast to coast and attracted the attention of Charlie Siringo, an operative for Pinkerton's National Detective Agency. Siringo cut his teeth herding longhorns in Texas. But his trail took him to Denver, where he went to work for William Pinkerton, a man whose clients were the companies targeted by the train robbers. From the agency's office in Denver, Siringo was sent on his mission to comb the West until he had found the Wild Bunch. It was an assignment to test the best that the law had to offer. Siringo trailed the gang into the Wyoming Rockies, but like phantoms, Butch Cassidy and the gun-happy Sundance gave him the slip. The unyielding land had erased all trace of the Wild Bunch. Butch Cassidy was good at everything he did. He won his spurs as an outlaw in Telluride, Colorado. The take was small, but it was a start. Soon after, he was serving time for horse theft. Yet jail was a breeze compared to facing Charlie Siringo. After the first train heist in Wyoming, Siringo followed the trail of stolen money all the way to Nashville, Tennessee. But though he combed the land like a bloodhound, he could find no trace of Butch and his gang. In fact, from the scene of the crime, Butch had gone west to Seattle, where he boarded a steamer for a leisurely cruise to Los Angeles. From there, he rode back to the gang's home base. His destination was an abandoned stage stop in Wyoming. A secret rendezvous had been arranged with officials of the UP, the railroad Butch had robbed. If the UP would drop their charges, Butch would go to work for them. After waiting for hours, Butch came to the conclusion that the UP had changed its mind. Long after Butch had left, the railroad men arrived. Their train was delayed. Were it not for that piece of bad luck, the history of the outlaw era might have taken a different course. Back Back in the high country, Butch reassembled the Wild Bunch and laid plans to teach the railroad a lesson. As usual, the express car was trashed, but no human was harmed. And even some lawmen reluctantly took their hats off to Butch. The great unbroken reaches of Wyoming were a boon to the Wild Bunch in their cat-and-mouse game with the law. But if anyone knew the territory better than Butch, it was Charlie Siringo. Now hot on Butch's heels, he tracked him down the outlaw trail that wound all the way from Montana to New Mexico. In a seedy saloon near the Mexican border, the trail came to an end. Posing as a desperado, Siringo learned from an informant that Butch himself owned the saloon. And along with the Wild Bunch, he was holed up at the moment in the mountains near the town. It was the break he'd spent years waiting for, and he wasted no time relaying the news to the Pinkerton office in Denver. The reply he received was disappointing. The head office had a hot tip that Butch was in Colorado, and they ordered Charlie there. For Siringo, it was a dead end. San Antonio, Texas, at the turn of the century. In its lusty bordellos, Butch and his buddy Sundance felt right at home. Their hostess in these escapades was the notorious Fanny Porter, a lady with a soft spot in her heart for men of dubious character with no shortage of money to burn. Between bouts with the ladies and binges in the gambling dens, Butch and his gang found the time to sit for a formal group portrait. It was to prove a costly mistake. The photo was soon in the hands of the Pinkerton office, and the faces of Butch and Sundance were swiftly dispatched to every law enforcement agency in the land. The game had changed, and even their traditional strongholds were no longer a refuge for the gang. After a bank job in Nevada, the Wild Bunch split up, with things heating up. Even the big money to be gained by robbing trains had lost its allure. The railroads were now fielding posse cars. Stationed at key junctions, they were manned by grim-faced men who were more than ready to deal with the Wild Bunch. It was 1901, the dawn of a century, and the American West no longer offered safe haven for armed gangs of train robbers. In Montana, the Wild Bunch played their swan song with characteristic style. The headlines echoed those of an era that was soon to disappear. The job had gone without a hitch, with no help from Butch or Sundance. Restless and rolling in cash, the two outlaws took in the sights of New York City, dining in the best restaurants and in the company of a lady friend, shopping in the finest stores. Then in the studio of a Manhattan photographer, Sundance and the lady posed in their new regalia. She she was Etta Place, a bored school teacher. And she and Sundance were now man and wife. With bulging suitcases, Sundance and Etta checked out of their comfortable quarters and headed by cab for the docks on the Hudson River. There they would join Butch Cassidy aboard a boat bound for South America. The West was now far behind, and ahead lay the promise of a new beginning in the wide open spaces of the Republic of Argentina. Buenos Aires. The city was the gateway to the Pampas and a mecca for fugitives from the law. For 3 years, Butch and Sundance and Etta lived law-abiding lives in a place far removed from the capital. Soon, however, they returned to the trade they knew best. No one is certain what happened then, for they vanished from the pages of history. Perhaps they met death in Bolivia. Or perhaps, as some have it, Butch returned home to put down his guns forever. As an old man, they say, he traveled the West, visiting old sidekicks and haunts. But whatever the truth, his legend rides on to this day. And just possibly, old Charlie Siringo still remains on his trail. In Wyoming, where memories of the Wild Bunch were still fresh, a young man set out to follow in Butch Cassidy's footsteps. He was Bill Carlisle, a cowboy turned train robber. In the years before the First World War, Carlisle would hold up no fewer than 5 Union Pacific trains and gain fame as the Lone Bandit. Strictly a solo act, Bill specialized in robbing the passengers. He was unfailingly polite and, like many famous train robbers before him, refused to rob the ladies. The technique made him an instant sensation, though the proceeds from his labors were often meager. In the Denver Post, he published a letter boasting that he would soon rob another train. The boast backfired. A former employer tipped off the law, but not before Bill made good on his promise. To his misfortune, Bill's injured ankle made him easy to spot, and he was arrested the following day. While other young men were dying in Europe, Bill spent the World War in the Wyoming pen. A model prisoner from the start, he led Liberty Bond drives for the war effort. And while locked up, he passed his time doing needlepoint. As America's boys rolled home from the front, Bill weaseled his way out of jail and promptly robbed another train. When 2 doughboys grabbed him, his gun went off. He escaped, but was badly injured. It didn't take long for a posse to find him, bringing an end to his daring career. But though Bill was gone, other train robbers were waiting. By the 1920s, robbing trains had become passé. It was an era of bright lights and boom times, the wild fling that swept over the nation in the wake of the war. It was a party fueled by bootleg booze and a wild new kind of crime. Lost in the hustle, a gang of brothers from Texas kept a tradition alive from a bygone era. A single train robbery brought them more money than any train robber earned before or since. Like many outlaws before them, the Ford Newton brothers were spawned by the plains of Texas. Willis, the eldest of the boys, did time in his 20s for stealing a bale of cotton. In jail, he learned that robbing trains was an easier way to make a living. It was 1914 when he held up his first train. After that, it began to be a habit. Willis, like the rest of the Newton boys, had a knack, and with his brothers, he put it to work. The boys rode horses to pull their first jobs. But soon, they were driving fine motor cars and making a living in style. Banks were favorite targets, and to minimize risk, they scouted during the day, then came back at night to do the job. The method seemed to be foolproof.
All we wanted was the money. We was just businessmen, like doctors and lawyers and storekeepers. Robbing banks and trains was our business.
The Newtons shunned dramatic escapes. In the warm months, they often spent the night in a cornfield while the police scoured the roads. With one man walking a beat to stay awake, the other brothers slept as best they could. Then in the morning, they drove on to scout the next town. And around the bend, there was the dream to quit while they were ahead. In Mexico, Willis figured they could settle down and live like kings. In the meantime, the boys from Texas indulged in flashy cars and planned their most daring heist. The target this time, a mail train out of Chicago. Before forcing the engineer to stop, the gang tossed four bums from the baggage car. A jar of formaldehyde hurled into the mail car brought the mail clerks out in a hurry. But in the confusion, a shot was fired by one of the members of the gang. Doc Newton was down, badly wounded. Then, with 60 bags of registered mail, the brothers piled into the getaway cars and sped toward Chicago. In the city, the Newtons hoped to find a doctor who could save their brother's life. But for the country boys, Chicago was an alien place with nowhere to turn for support. The next day's papers were full of news, and the underworld was suddenly alive with rumors. Before long, someone had tipped off the cops. But the Newtons still had one card to play. In exchange for short prison terms, they agreed to turn over the loot, which totaled a staggering $3 million. In the Siskiyou Mountains of Oregon, a lust for adventure gone wrong led to the most brutal train robbery in America's history. October 1923. Three robbers botched an attempt to rob the train, then killed the train's crew of four. Banner headlines proclaimed the public outrage and demanded that the killings be avenged. No one knew at the time that the killers were clean-cut young men who had never before committed a crime. Fanning out from the site of the murders, police crews with bloodhounds combed through the mountains without finding a clue to the identity of the killers. But in a laboratory in Berkeley, California, items found at the crime scene yielded far more. Forensic science, a new tool for crime fighting, had been brought to bear to solve an unsolvable crime. A seemingly blank piece of paper bore the name of Hugh de Autremont. The lab's investigation pointed to three brothers who had worked as lumberjacks in the Oregon woods. The report would be their downfall. Ray, Roy, and Hugh de Autremont were the sons of a barber in Eugene, Oregon. 3 years later, after more than 2 million copies of the wanted poster were circulated, the brothers were arrested. For their father, it was the end of a nightmare. The brothers got life in prison. Asked in the 1970s to explain their motive, one of the brothers shook his head and said, "Whatever possessed us to do such a thing?" Through a good part of a century, the railroad had been both a boon and a curse, drawing the nation together while drawing robbers like moths to a flame. Lured by its wealth and its power, the train robbers, like the great iron beast that they battled, have faded into history.